This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia says the West's supply of weapons and mercenaries to Ukraine would lead to a global collapse. A school shooting in the U.S. state of Iowa leaves one student dead and two others injured. Also ahead, Syria says the United Nations needs to avoid double standards in its response to Israel's acts of aggression. Thank you for joining us. Russia and Ukraine trade blames over the evacuation of civilians as the conflict between the two countries is about to enter its third week. Addressing a Security Council meeting, Ukraine's UN ambassador accused Russia of violating the two countries' earlier agreement on humanitarian corridors. Sergei Kislytsy said Moscow insists that all passages for the evacuation of civilians must go through Russia and Belarus. He also accused Russia of shelling evacuees and the routes allocated for the corridors. But the Russian envoy denied the accusation. Vasily Nabenzy said representatives from the Red Cross were invited to the corridors at the request of Ukraine to ensure the safety of the evacuees. Nabenzy blamed Ukrainian nationalists for breaching the agreement on the evacuation process.
The radicals in Mariupol violated this agreement. As is clear from a radio conversation that was intercepted between two commanders of the Nationalist Battalion Azov, that is in Volnovakhi, the radicals there were told to shoot at the legs of those who were heading for the humanitarian corridors. Those who risked life and limb to try and leave Mariupol, when they reached the checkpoints to exit the city, were shot on site by Ukrainian Nazis. There's a great deal of video evidence of this.
The Russian envoy accused Ukrainian nationalists of using civilians as human shields. He said they hold thousands of civilians, including foreigners, hostage. Nabenzy also suggested Russia will open humanitarian corridors on Tuesday to allow civilians to leave Ukraine towards Russian territory. Meanwhile, the UN aid chief has called on all parties to allow safe passage for civilians in Ukraine to leave areas of active hostilities in the direction they choose. According to the UN, more than 1.7 million Ukrainians have crossed into Central Europe. The United Nations has also confirmed the deaths of around 400 civilians in Ukraine since the beginning of Russia's military operation there. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, says right-wing militias are to blame for the failure of plans to evacuate citizens from war zones.
Right-wing militias and these Nazi elements that are now running to the cities to gain cover and exploiting the civilians and using them as human shields is an indication of the desperation of Zelensky's forces, and also a revelation of the darkest impulses behind the true nature of their regime, their character. They're not at all interested in the benefit of the Ukrainian people. They're not at all interested in the preservation of Ukrainian culture. They're about war and doing the bidding of their puppet masters, which is primarily the United States. So they've been pushed into this, resist at all costs, cause maximum damage, sabotage your own nuclear fields, blame it on the Russians, set off your own power outages, destroy your own water sources, and blame it on the Russians in a massive propaganda war. But I think the Russians are doing the opposite. They're winning the hearts and minds of the local people by providing safety, providing corridors for humanitarian aid, providing exit points for those who want to get out of the way. And Russia is going to focus on the annihilation of the right-wing Nazi militia groups. And I think this will be all over in a matter of days.
Russia's military offensive against Ukraine and the ensuing Western sanctions are wreaking a havoc on global markets and economy, with Moscow warning of unpredictable and catastrophic consequences. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and the European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. On the Nord Stream 2 sanctions, Novak warned that Russia could cut gas supplies via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany, but it hasn't made such a decision yet. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Together with Ukraine, it accounts for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market. Pakistan has resisted the pressure of the West, particularly the European countries, to condemn Russia over its attack on Ukraine. Islamabad also reacted sharply to the unusual move by the Western diplomatic missions using social media platforms to put pressure on Pakistan. Kamran Yusuf has the details.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols. On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? Are we your slaves? That whatever you say, we will do.
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
But the only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective, that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades, but now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country opposes both war and sanctions. He made the remarks in a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, which touched upon the conflict in Ukraine. Amir Abdollahian said Tehran's cooperation with any country, including Russia, should not be affected by sanctions. For his part, Lavrov slammed the sanctions imposed on his country and stressed the need for closer cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Separately, Amir Abdollahian had a phone call with his Turkish counterpart. He told Mevlut Çavuşoğlu that Tehran supports efforts to find a political solution for the Ukraine conflict and stands ready to lend a helping hand. Çavuşoğlu said he will participate in a joint meeting with his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts to facilitate a ceasefire. He said it's highly important to try to ease tensions in Ukraine as the conflict could lead to a humanitarian catastrophe. One teenager is killed and two others critically injured in a shooting outside a high school in the U.S. state of Iowa. The incident happened in the state capital, Des Moines, shortly before 3 p.m. local time. A police statement says the gunfire appears to have come from a passing vehicle. Three potential suspects have been detained, but no charges have been filed. Mass killings involving firearms are common in the U.S., with the number of victims on the rise. Over 80 mass shootings have already been recorded this year, with the total number of gun violence deaths standing at nearly 8,000. The majority of Americans favor greater gun controls. However, lax laws and the right to bear arms have hampered efforts to clamp down on the number of weapons in circulation. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist. He's shared with us his view of why shootings are still a major issue in the United States. Let's take a listen.
This is a long and sad story. This recent shooting, it's tragic, as they all are, and we will soon hear the elected officials offering their thoughts and prayers to the victims. Thoughts and prayers are not enough. They need to legislate to get the guns out of the hands of so many people. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court always says that, or has stated repeatedly, that the right to bear arms trumps everything else. They forget that the right to bear arms was written into law when the U.S. had a standing militia. It didn't have a regular army as it has today. But the National Rifle Association, which is the biggest pro-gun lobby in the United States, has been very powerful for years. That power is diminishing now, but it has been very powerful for years and has invoked a thought in people's minds that owning guns is important and is necessary, and that any attempt to restrict gun ownership at all is a major infringement on their rights. This is simply not true. It's a myth, but many people have come to believe it, and that's why we have the problems that the United States has today.
Venezuela's president confirms he's had a meeting with a high-level U.S. delegation visiting Caracas and what appears to be a U-turn in Washington's hostile policy towards the Latin American state. Nicolas Maduro said the meeting was, in his own words, respectful, cordial, and very diplomatic, and that the two sides agreed on an agenda for future discussions. Earlier, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the trip focused on a number of issues, including energy security. Media are quoting informed sources as saying that the talks focused on the easing of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela's oil. The U.S. is looking to use Venezuela's huge energy reserves amid the Western pressure campaign against Russia over its Ukraine offensive. Maduro was among a few world leaders who have openly supported Russia's military move. The relations between Washington and Caracas have been sour. The White House cut off diplomatic relations in 2019. Syria says the latest Israeli act of aggression and Daesh terrorist attack coming in quick succession illustrates clear and direct coordination between the two entities. The Syrian Foreign Ministry warned about the repercussions of Israel's repeated attacks. It said the raids inflict heavy material and human losses, besides causing fear among the civilian population, especially women and children. The ministry called on the United Nations and the UN Security Council to fulfill their responsibility and avoid double standards in responding to such, quote, seriously risky actions. Israel's Monday airstrikes near the Syrian capital, Damascus, killed two civilians. A day earlier, over a dozen Syrian army forces were killed in a Daesh terrorist attack in the central province of Homs. Israeli forces kill another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Quds, bringing to three the number of Palestinians killed since Sunday. According to Palestinian sources, the regime's forces fatally shot the man after he wounded two Israeli soldiers in a knife attack. The incident comes a day after two separate killings of Palestinian teenagers in Al-Quds. A 16-year-old boy was killed in the Old City area after he, according to the Israeli military, threw a firebomb at an army post. Another Palestinian teen was gunned down the same day over a stabbing attack that left one Israeli officer injured. Tensions are running high in the occupied territories over Israel's brutal crackdown on Palestinians venting anger at the regime's atrocious policy. Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities to denounce the tightening of the siege imposed on the impoverished nation by Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif Al-Washli reports from Sana'a.
Under the title, the detention of fuel ships is a U.S. decision and our choice is Yemen's hurricane operations, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to protest against the Saudi blockade imposed on the country.
The Yemeni people today came out to send a message to the world that they will not sit idle against this stifling siege backed by the U.S. and enforced under the supervision of the U.K. and members of the Saudi-led coalition. The siege is aimed to bring the Yemenis to their knees.
The protests are taking place amid the worst fuel crisis in Yemen since the beginning of the war, as Saudi Arabia keeps seizing Yemeni oil vessels despite obtaining entry permits by the UN. The long lines of people queuing at fuel stations in the capital Sana'a have reached 4 kilometers for the first time.
The Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni oil ships amid the silence of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council overlooks the violations of Saudi Arabia and its allies. We call on the international community to look at Yemen as it does with Ukraine and to stand by the millions of Yemenis who have been suffering for 7 years.
Recently, Saudi Arabia tightened the siege it imposes on Yemen and led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage. This has pushed the healthcare system to the verge of collapse, threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children.
Protesters hold the U.S. responsible for supporting the Saudi detention of oil ships, saying Washington is a major partner in the war against their country. They believe that the Yemeni army operations against Emirati and Saudi territories, especially those against Aramco facilities, are the only way to lift the siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that's a wrap for this hour's World News.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah,
the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Homage to the Prophet's fourth infallible heir. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and congratulations to you all on another auspicious day. In fact, the third consecutive day of celebrations of the blessed month of Sha'ban. Today is the 5th of Sha'ban, the birth anniversary of the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala. Stay with us for an exclusive feature on the fourth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Whenever a thought comes to your mind that you are better than any other person, then think along these lines. If the person is older than you, then remind yourself that he is better than you in matters of Islam because he has done more good deeds than you have. If the person is younger than you, then remind yourself that this person is better than you because he has committed less sins than you have. If he is of your age, then your argument should be, he is better than you in matters of Islam, since you know of your own sins but not of his. What you heard are bezels of wisdom, but these are not the words of any philosopher who might have arrived at this undeniable truth after years of contemplation and a life of stumbling in the dark. As a matter of fact, these golden guidelines for our salvation were taught to us by a person who was free of any faults and whimsical thoughts, since he was a member of that select group called the Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless cleanliness and pristine purity God Almighty has vouchsafed in Ayah 33 of Surah Zab of the Noble Quran. He's the person whose birthday we celebrate every year on the 5th of Sha'ban. To be more precise, he is Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, peace upon him, famous as Zainul Abidin, or Ornament of the Worshippers of God, who was born in Medina over a millennium and four centuries ago in the year 38 AH, 2 years before the martyrdom of his grandfather, the one and only commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. As the son and successor of the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, he was the direct great-grandson of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. His mother was the princess of Persia, Hazrat Shahr Banu, peace upon her, daughter of the last Sasanid emperor of Iran, Iraq, Yazgird III, and because of that lady's pious personality, he was often called Ibnul Khiyaratain, meaning son of the two excellent ones. Such an impeccable lineage did not mean that life was a bed of roses for him and his family. After losing his mother to the cold hands of death while still an infant, he was brought up by his immaculate paternal aunt, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her. He had entered the third year of his life when he saw the end of the only instance of the model government of social justice in 48 with the martyrdom of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, in Kufa, where the Prophet's divinely designated heir was struck on the head by the poisoned sword of the renegade Abdurrahman ibn Muljam. Some 7 months later, in 41 AH, the caliphate or temporal rule of the vast Muslim realm was deceitfully seized from his uncle and future father-in-law, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, by the rebellious governor of Syria, Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan. The boy found the noble Ahlul Bayt under renewed persecution, as they had been since the passing away of the Prophet in 11 AH, the usurpation of the right of political leadership of his grandfather Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the tragic martyrdom of his grandmother, the noblest lady of all times, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her. When he reached the age of 12, the divine mantle of Imamat came to rest on the shoulders of his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, following the martyrdom of his uncle through a fatal dose of poison by the charlatan Muawiyah. Now, his father became the target of enmity of the hypocrites, masquerading as Muslims, especially the accursed Umayyad regime. In 68, as a 22-year-old in the full bloom of youth, he had to hurriedly leave Medina along with his father and the rest of the family when the godless Yazid usurped the caliphate and demanded allegiance to his tyrannical rule. In early 61 AH, the caravan of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, arrived on the fateful plain of Karbala, where on the day of Ashura, the 23-year-old sick and bedridden man witnessed the tragic martyrdom of his father, brothers, uncles, cousins, and close companions of the Ahlul Bayt. It was under these heartening conditions that Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, formally took charge of the Divine Trust of Imamat, which began with chains and fetters around his limbs. And the forced march of the mainly women and children survivors of history's most heart-wrenching tragedy to Kufa and then to Damascus in Syria, the capital of Yazid. As the fourth infallible heir of the Seal of Messengers, his frail figure now rose to the occasion. He delivered a moving sermon to the people of Kufa, who were watching in amusement the parading of the noble captives with heads of the martyrs mounted on lanes. After waving his hand to calm them down, he said, "O people of Kufa, I am the son of Hussein, peace upon him. I am Ali, the grandson of Ali, Fatima, and the Prophet, peace upon them. I am the son of that Imam whose sons were killed and his properties looted and plundered and his family held prisoners before you. You wrote invitation letters to my father. When he came towards you, you killed him. What will you reply to God and his prophet on the day of judgment?" Time does allow us to dwell on the famous sermon of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, in the court of Yazid in Damascus that shook the Umayyad regime to its very foundations and forced the tyrant to release the Ahlul Bayt and send them back to Medina. During the next 34 years of his life, when the Tawabin or penitents of Iraq staged an uprising followed by Mukhtar Thaqafi to avenge the blood of his father by bringing to justice almost all perpetrators of the tragedy of Karbala, his tears never ran dry and continued to flow, whether in grief or as thanksgiving to the Lord Most High for his endless favors. His period of imamat was a critical situation in view of the tussle for political power between Abdullah ibn Zubayr and the Umayyads, who were both unworthy of leadership. Both were hostile to him and the Hashemite clan. Both wanted to wipe out the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. As rulers rose, played havoc with Muslim blood, and fell to their doom, the fourth Imam adopted a unique form of jihad through the medium of supplications in the divine court. He not just expounded the fundamentals of faith and God's infinite mercy, but also unraveled the mysteries of the science, as is evident by his reference to the weight of light and other amazing facts, something unthinkable in those days. His lasting legacy is Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, famous as Psalms of the Progeny of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He also dictated to his disciples the Risalat al-Huquq, or Treatise of Rights, which details even the most minute rights and has been hailed as a million times better than the UN Charter of Human Rights. Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, however, was no ascetic, unattached and unconcerned of worldly affairs. When the regime in Damascus was helpless in the face of pressures from the Byzantine Empire regarding supply of coins that were engraved with emblems of the Christian creed, he magnanimously sent his son and eventual successor, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, to Syria to give the necessary advice and make arrangements for setting up of the first ever mint in the Islamic realm, thus saving the faith of the Muslims and the drain of the bullion. In 95 AH, at the age of 57, the fourth Imam was martyred through a fatal dose of poison given by Walid I, but not before he had delivered the followers of the Ahlul Bayt from the thorniest periods of their lives. Today, although his tomb in what was the grand mausoleum in the sacred Baqi cemetery of Medina, along with the tombs of his uncle Imam Hassan, his son Imam Muhammad Baqir, and his grandson Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon them, have been blasphemously demolished by the ungodly Wahhabi cult. Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, continues to rule the hearts of believers all over the world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. And welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This week, we'll explore how the Palestinian Authority keeps trying to curry favour with elite decision makers in the US and UK, despite all the evidence that it just doesn't work. A recent example was when Mahmoud Abbas met with the US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The truth is, pro-Israel lobby groups are increasingly penetrating Western governments to starve the Palestinian Authority of cash. All its activities are being constrained, down to the availability of school textbooks. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's continuing colonization of Palestine and explore what can be done to stop it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report on the Board of Deputies of British Jews and its part in the ongoing attack on the Palestinian Authority.
The Board of Deputies claims to only represent the Jewish community in Britain. But when digging a little deeper into its background, we find an organisation which lobbies governments on behalf of the Israeli regime. Today, we delve into the ways in which the BOD contributes to one of the Zionist entity's key aims of undermining the very Palestinian Authority which has served it so well. First, let us examine whether the Board of Deputies is in fact an Israel lobby group. The director of the Institute for Economic Affairs, Mark Littlewood, recently asked a pertinent question about the organisation.
The British Board of Jewish Deputies, do we think their list of donors should be in the public domain? What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, it's a very compelling answer, but you haven't answered the question, which is who funds you? You haven't named a single.
Well, I told you why I won't answer the question. I don't believe that organisations.
It's quite convenient,
isn't it? Well, I don't think it is revealing. Do you think the list of donors to the British Board of Jewish Deputies should be listed in the public domain?
Are the British Board of Deputies lobbying government ministers on this,
yes,
that, and the other?
Yes.
In the same way that you are in quite a.
Well, more so. I mean, much richer than we are. The Church of England, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who does fund the Board of Deputies? Well, despite their opaque status, we were able to track down at least three. Trevor Chin, the well-known Israel lobbyist, funds the Board of Deputies alongside the Jerusalem Foundation and the JNF, which both build illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Chin is a vice president of the Jewish Leadership Council, which also pumps funds into the Board of Deputies. Another funder we are able to identify was the Katkin Puswillow Charitable Trust, which also funds the Settlement Building Jerusalem Foundation and the British Conservative Party. The senior vice president of the Board of Deputies, Gary Mond, recently resigned from his position after it came to light he had posted Islamophobic ideas online, notably that civilization was at war with Islam. He was simultaneously the honorary treasurer at the JNF, which boasts the prime minister of the Israeli regime as a patron. He has retained his position at the JNF despite his comments. The Board of Deputies was essential to the war against Corbynism in Britain and has worked closely with the Trevor Chin-funded Keir Starmer to further cleanse the Labour Party of pro-Palestinian actors. The Board of Deputies 2020 Trustees report boasts that the organisation enjoys a close working relationship with the Israeli Embassy in the UK and strengthened links with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the Israeli Defence Forces. It also boasts about lobbying other Arab governments and hosting events with the Israeli Embassy. In 2016, the Board of Deputies took credit for a decision of the British government changing its aid arrangement for the Palestinian Authority to providing the salaries of health and education public servants on a vetted list only. The Board of Deputies, which has a history of editing textbooks in the UK, also welcomed the EU's report criticising the Palestinian Authority's school curriculum in 2021. Several Israel lobby groups, including the Board of Deputies, are working to change the material which Palestinian children study, and their main target is the Palestinian Authority. So the question we must ask, why are Israel lobby groups, including the Board of Deputies, working against the Palestinian Authority, which has bent over backwards for the Zionist entity?
To discuss the Board of Deputies and its relations with Israel, we're joined today by two expert guests. Mo Haider was renowned for his sharp-witted and eloquent commentary about Arsenal Football Club. But last year, he was axed from the popular Arsenal Fans TV channel after appearing on air wearing a Palestine badge on his hoodie. AFTV said claims that he was sacked because of this were baseless. He's joined by our regular programme expert, David Miller, who's an academic and former professor at Bristol University, as well as being the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Welcome to the show. Mo, can I come to you first, if I can? Now, you were dismissed from AFTV for showing your support for Palestine. Can you just tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, unfortunately, during the pandemic, we were filming remotely from home, and prior to the pandemic, doing it in person. Now, prior to the pandemic, I wore a badge on a jacket, and that said Free Palestine. The channel took exception to that, asked me to remove the word free because it was a political statement, which I thought, fine, I can understand they don't want politics on their channel, wasn't happy. But I censored the word free and it displayed that censorship and I thought, OK, fine, that's dealt with. Things took a more sinister turn and a turn for the worse when we were filming remotely and I was just wearing a hoodie and it just has a Palestine badge, almost like a football emblem in a way, on the chest. And then one day logged on to the portal where we were doing the filming and I was asked to remove the hoodie. And I was really surprised. I was quite upset, to be honest with you. And when I questioned as to why I should remove that hoodie and whether the same treatment would have been levied to me if that was a hoodie that said, for example, England, I was just told, all right, just forget it. Let's just crack on with it. When I inquired more, I actually found out that apparently threats had been received of legal action against AFTV on the basis of me wearing that hoodie. And just to be clear, all it said was Palestine. It had red, green, white and black.
Yeah, and were the Board of Deputies involved in any way in this whole affair?
Not at that point, but the way the Board of Deputies became involved is that when things came to a head, when Palestine was attacked, you know, a few months ago, I publicly called out AFTV because I was frankly really resentful about the treatment that I had received. Yeah. So I called them out on social media and said, when are you going to stop being complicit in the suppression? Because all of these microaggressions are forms of suppression. To just remove this Palestine badge here or remove this, you know, little signs of Palestine from different areas. When that happened and I called them out, they then kicked me off the channel. They didn't like the fact that I had done that. And in response to that, they made some claims about me and I wanted to clear the air. So I released a quite a long, comprehensive video. Yeah. And as part of that, I wanted to really hammer down the fact that they found the Palestine badge, or the hoodie that I was wearing, to be not appropriate for their platform. Yet a video that had been uploaded to their platform, and I actually made them aware of this, contained a really crude, vulgar, anti-Semitic remark. I contacted the Board of Deputies for British Jews to ask them on their opinion and their advice as to whether I should share that video or just refer to that video, because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't causing offence to the Jewish population that would watch the video that I released. So that's when they became involved.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, particularly in light of all the flag waving that we're seeing for Ukraine at the moment. But David, I mean, I wondered if whether you could just tell us a bit more about the involvement of the Board of Deputies in pro-Israel lobbying. And I understand that Tal Offer, who's a senior figure in the Board of Deputies, has been quite instrumental in some of this stuff. Maybe you could just expand on that a bit more for us.
Well, the board, historically, for most of its existence, for centuries now, was an anti-Zionist organisation. It only became Zionist in 1939. But it's become, since then, it's become a very prominent lobbyist for the Israeli state and has been very active along with a whole range of other groups which we would identify as being pro-Israel lobby groups. I mean, the Board of Deputies sort of poses as being just a communal body to represent Jewish people in general. It's more than that, and it says this in its report, as we saw in the report there, that they actually talk about their active collaboration with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. That's the ministry tasked by the Israeli government for undermining BDS and Palestine solidarity activities all over the world. So there's a very strong relationship there between the Israeli government and the Board of Deputies, which is contrary to what they say they do. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there are many interesting people in the Board of Deputies. We saw one there, and there's been a number of others who have been accused, found guilty of Islamophobic activities. But yeah, the Rolf Tal Offer is an interesting one. This is a guy who's an Israeli who came over here, did a degree, went back to Israel, worked for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Right.
And then back in this country, he has been since 2012 at least involved in trying to stir up what effectively became the witch hunt in 2015 when Jeremy Corbyn was elected. He's been involved in many occasions trying to smear pro-Palestine activists as being anti-Semitic. And one of the key things that he did in 2014-15 was he was core to the infrastructure of pro-Israel groups, which subsequently was at the forefront of attacking Jeremy Corbyn. So he's had a very key role in British politics and isn't widely known.
No, indeed. I just wondered about whether I could ask you, I mean, were you surprised by what happened to you, and how did it make you feel, you know, when you were booted off the channel?
Well, you made reference to Jeremy Corbyn there. I wasn't surprised because I knew there'd be a response. It's a very emotive, sensitive issue. And when I publicly call them out, that was off the back of a lot of things that had happened privately.
Yeah.
So I wasn't surprised. I saw that it could potentially, that could happen, that I would be kicked off. But in terms of how it made me feel, I just felt frustrated. You know, I think the double standards, the hypocrisy is what annoys so many people, including myself, where, you know, there were other contributors to the channel that wore emblems or text of different countries, and this was just that.
No,
so it was that hypocrisy that made me feel very upset. But ultimately, it's not about me. I'm just a tiny speck, you know, tiny drop in the ocean. I just wanted to really highlight to people that if that's what's happened to me at such an irrelevant level on a fan channel, what happens to the people who are right at the top?
I wonder if you could just say a bit. I mean, I think you've been in communication with Tal Offer that David mentioned. Just tell us a little bit about that, if you can, briefly.
And I will be respectful of the fact that it was a conversation not in the public domain, so I'll respect him on that basis. But I, when I contacted the British or the Board of Deputies for British Jews, it was actually Tal Offer that I communicated with, and I asked him for his opinion on whether I should share the video or not. And I think the thing that upsets me and that I find really frustrating is that I, in good faith, went to them because I hoped that they do what it says on the tin. You know, this is for British Jews. Never in my wildest imaginations would I expected them to be sort of masquerading in that sense, where they're actually looking after the interests or have the interests of the Israeli government in their minds or in their hearts. And, I feel quite let down by that and misled.
Indeed. Well, look, I mean, we'll come back and talk in a moment after we've just seen this report on the Palestinian Authority's response to the campaigns against it.
When we see the Palestinian Authority meeting with American political leaders like the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in Ramallah recently, the question arises about the efficacy of the strategy of the Palestinian Authority. U.S. political leaders are not likely to support the Palestinians in the foreseeable future. Instead, they will facilitate the normalization of the Zionist entity. In this, they will walk in lockstep with the agents and assets of the Zionist movement. But the liberation of Palestine will require that Zionism in Palestine and around the world be dismantled. One of the key assets of the Zionist regime in the UK is the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Though it presents itself as purely a communal Jewish group, it recently admitted to enjoying, quote, a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy in the UK and has strengthened links. But it doesn't just lobby for Israel. It also actively targets the Palestinian Authority. Here's how. The BOD has been active in trying to censor and manipulate school textbooks on Palestine in the UK. In that case, it worked with the UK Lawyers for Israel, a lobby group with close links to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Despite their best efforts, Palestine campaigners have reversed this institutional bias. The BOD has campaigned to undermine the school curriculum of the Palestinian Authority as part of a wider EU effort to target the PA, despite a UN-funded study concluding that Palestinian textbooks adhere to UNESCO standards. The BOD has supported the EU and UK government in slashing funding to the Palestinian Authority despite its servility to the Israeli regime. Dismantling Zionism in Palestine will also require that it's dismantled in the UK, the US, and worldwide.
Well, what did you make of that report, David? I mean, do you think the Palestinian Authority is underestimating the range of forces that are against it?
Yeah, I think that people recognise that the Palestinian Authority is in a difficult position. And they also are, especially in Palestine, very frustrated by its lack of progress, of a proper response to the Israeli government. And it's, some people talk even of collaboration. And I think that there's some arguments around that which are worthy of consideration. But it seems to me that one of the problems is that they haven't really understood that the need to target Zionism as an actually functioning ideology, meaning the Israeli regime in Palestine, but also the worldwide Zionist movement, which, of course, has really quite strong links, especially in this country and in the US and other countries, with government. The Palestinian Authority is never going to trump that influence, and so we need to focus in particular on dismantling Zionism as an ideology, and indeed in dismantling every single Zionist organisation across the world, not just the Zionist organisations in Israel.
I mean, how do you think we should respond then in this conflation between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism? I mean, that's a real problem, isn't it?
Well, that's been the key weapon of choice that the Israelis and the Zionist movement more broadly have used in the last 5 or 6 years against the left, against Muslims, in the US, in France and Germany, and, of course, in the UK. Mm. And we need, of course, to push back against that. Anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Mm. Many anti-Zionists are Jewish, of course, and there are many Zionists who themselves are not Jewish. Yeah. So there is no clear relationship between Judaism and Zionism, sure. Although, of course, the Israeli government wants to suggest that there is.
Indeed. And what about this Alex Brummer character who is a very senior figure in the Board of Deputies? Tell us a bit about him.
Well, this is one of many examples which we've come across in this programme before. That Brummer is involved with the Board of Deputies, but that's not his main job. He works his main job in the Daily Mail. He's a very senior journalist in the Daily Mail, but at the same time, he has this role at the Board of Deputies. That's a clear structural conflict of interest, which, you know, in any other circumstance, people will be pointing out and saying is a problem. But it's not only that. He's also the chair of this thing, I don't know if you've come across it, called the Abraham Initiatives.
Right.
And this is an organisation which is funded by the Israeli government and is set up to foster closer relationships between Israeli institutions and other organisations around the world. So it's a very strong and clear Israel lobby group. And this is a guy who, when he was writing in the Daily Mail during the Corbyn period, was writing articles attacking Corbyn. And he's not the only person who was doing that, not the only person who had Zionist conflicts of interest. And it's, of course, not only Zionists in the press who will write pro-Israel stuff, but this is an actual issue that you've got people who have particular political commitments which are not generally disclosed, and that results in them writing stories in the paper which are inimical to the interests of a large section of the population.
Mm. Mo, you've come up against the Zionist movement, haven't you, in your work on Arsenal Football Club? I mean, do you think that we should be doing more to highlight the role of the Israel lobby? I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
I think Israel lobby, or any lobby, are very influential parts of society in this day and age, especially in the US. We see that with lobbies, really being quite influential. So I think transparency is what the principle is here. And it doesn't really matter what lobby it is. Where society is going to be vastly influenced by a lobby, I want that transparency as a member of that society. So I think that's what it comes down to, that principle.
Mm. I mean, a lot of people, are fearful, I think, about speaking out, aren't they? In relation to support for Palestine, in relation to, indeed, calling out, for example, the board of British Jews. What's your thoughts about, how do we kind of overcome that fear? I mean, clearly, you were very loud and proud in your support for Palestine. I mean, what sort of message would you give to people who do feel cowed by, the range of the forces which are thrown at them?
It's really hard because at a point you have to decide whether you're making a sacrifice. And for me, I felt as though it was worth it. I feel passionately enough to say that if certain doors close to me, then so be it. I think it's just about doing the right thing and what sort of conviction you have in your belief that is essential to your day-to-day existence, doing that right thing. So if you do feel that passionately, great, but where people's livelihoods are affected, it's a really, really tough choice. My message would just be that, wherever possible, try and do that right thing.
No, indeed. And, I mean, David, I mean, have you got any sort of personal experience of the Board of Deputies? See a wry smile there. I guess you probably have. I mean, perhaps you could share that with us.
I was recently sacked from my job at the University of Bristol, which was the result of a 3-year-long campaign by the Zionist movement, in which the Board of Deputies played a role, along with, a virtual shopping list of pro-Israel lobby groups, which most people, I guess, won't even have heard the names of. I mean, a huge number of different organisations were involved in the attempt to have me sacked, and they were successful in the end. So, I mean, the Board of Deputies is one of those organisations, but this is a set of organisations which work together. I mean, if you look at this take a step back and look at the Zionist movement itself in this country. I mean, if you look only at the ones which are formerly members of organisations which are part of the World Zionist Organisation, there's over 200 of those in the UK, and that doesn't even include the Board of Deputies or the Jewish Leadership Council or the Labour Friends of Israel or any of those organisations. So there are literally hundreds of organisations whose mission is to defend Israel and to promote Israel. And so, we face quite an uphill task to bring that out into the public domain, to allow people to see the magnitude of the efforts put into defending Israeli settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing, which goes on day by day. And so we have a huge a road ahead of us, but I think we're now beginning to see clearly that this is a significant threat, not just to British democracy, but to world peace, and needs to be seriously taken on. And that's the next steps. People need to see clearly what the Zionist movement is and how then to dismantle it.
I mean, I must say, I was elected to Parliament in 2010, and I was quite surprised by the influence of the Zionist lobby in Parliament. All the political parties, actually. I've got a huge cohort of members of Parliament who are, Labour friends of Israel, Conservative friends of Israel, and so on. And I mean, just in your case, David, I understand a very senior Conservative, Robert Jenrick, didn't he, intervene with a view to trying to get you dismissed from your post? I mean, this is almost unprecedented, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't just him. There were a number of ministers, a number of MPs. I think there were 88 parliamentarians signed a letter against me. There were select committee sessions. There were all sorts of direct interventions with the university, the local MPs. My Labour MP, of course, was part of that process of having me sacked. So, yes, I mean, this was an assault by, what should we say, almost the entire British establishment at the behest, in the end, of assets of the State of Israel. So that's a pretty extraordinary set of affairs. And it took that kind of effort for them to intimidate the University of Bristol into sacking me, which is what happened.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I guess, Mo, you know, given what's happened to you and to David there, I mean, it just shows, I suppose, doesn't it, the power of the Zionist lobby. But I think, would you agree that, knowledge is power? The more that we can actually expose the role of the Zionist lobby, hopefully that might give people confidence briefly, if you could maybe just comment on that.
Absolutely. And I think that especially what's going on in this current situation with Russia and Ukraine, a lot of people are seeing parallels. And, whilst we all wish for the best outcome there for the Ukrainians, in this day and age, especially with the rise of social media as well, I think there's a bit more unfiltered reporting and unfiltered images and videos that people are being able to see. I think that's a key task to continue that in order to fight against this.
Indeed. Well, listen, thanks very much indeed to both of you. I think that's been a really interesting discussion. OK, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. I've been Chris Williamson. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
Analysis reveals how much faster Omicron spreads and evades the immune system compared with the previous variant. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Smriti Malapati Ryder. This article is published under the heading COVID-19,